Hello and welcome back. I am Rick Watson and you are watching the post Black Friday, Cyber Monday, post Thanksgiving, pre-Christmas, pre-NRF version of the Watson Weekend. I'm your host. I think there are other people here.
Yeah, we're here. We're happy. We're celebrating. We're marked safe from the holidays. Jessica Lisewski, Nick Kaplan, great to see you again, my friend.
Always
looking so dapper as usual. So we've got a lot going on. Before we broke, we had two Jeopardy style shows, which was really just our fun way of reflecting on the year. We had all these amazing guests, so many really great insights. And it was a nice way to just kind of put a cherry on top of the Watson Weekend Sunday in celebrating all the magic that we've created this year. Rick finally redeemed himself. You know, he is loser no more. There was a bit of a protest. We had to bring it to the producers. We thought Kelly won, but Rick did rack up the points. So how does that victory feel, my friend?
It feels good. It tastes, it's like a revenge is a dish best served cold. It's been such a cold winter since I had won anything that I was serving it up.
It had been very dark and very cold and sad and bleak, but you're back.
We had the holidays. The protest has been filed.
Your protest, that protest. All right. And we might, you know, Kelly might come back and he's, you know, ready for vengeance too. So, you know, we always have the results that come in. It's almost like, you know, the whether it's betting or something else, you kind of look at the sales coming down, the sports best, who lost, who won. What do you guys take away from the holiday recaps? Was it gangbusters? Did it anything surprise you?
I mean, I think the power of Black Friday surprised me a bit. I knew that there was some gas sort of left in the tank, but
yeah,
I didn't really realize it would be as strong. And then I'd say my second surprise was that Cyber Monday didn't come on stronger, that it didn't have that kind of like actual. Yeah. So those were my two surprises. What about you?
Yeah. For me, I think it was almost a boring Black Friday, meaning like we're up between 3 to 9%. A year. We don't know exactly where it's going to fall, but we know it's going to be up, and it's going to be up kind of about where everyone expected. It wasn't going to be down.
Yeah.
And it wasn't down. So I feel like from that point of view, like I was listening to the Walmart earnings call 2 months ago, and they were like, we just had a good back to school. We're going to have a good holiday. Just mark it down. And I don't know. I marked it down.
They did.
And they did. So
I think let's not let that play on words be lost. I marked it down.
Ba-doom.
Because
we'll roll it back.
That will be the January highlight in the earnings call will be I marked it down.
Very true. And for Walmart, they're not marking down, guys. They roll back. They roll back, friends. Yeah. So yeah, that one was interesting. We also had a little outage situation that I think surprised folks. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, it seems like Shopify admin was down for some number of hours on Black Friday, and that also affected checkouts.
Yeah.
I was in there Cyber Monday, and the day before I was using Sidekick, and then Cyber Monday, my trusted Sidekick was kicked to the curb. I could not use him. I guess he was using up too many CPUs.
Lord help you if you wanted to make promotional changes on Cyber Monday, right?
Yes.
I think that people don't really understand. It's like there's the front end experience, which the consumer engages with, and then there's all the back end where the decision making and the execution happens. And it was a very tense morning for many people who were unclear of like their performance as well as changes they wanted to make. So no bueno, my friends.
It is not. On a day like that, where you do have people looking at intraday, making reactions, be switching things out, trying to be reactive or proactive, very rough o'clock for that type of situation. So
exactly.
May the uptime be with you for the rest of the holiday.
Well, it's funny, and I know we're going to move on, but what's funny is a friend of the show, Kelly Getch, actual winner of the Jeopardy, did make a post on LinkedIn that I thought was really telling, which is like, you know, Walmart rolled out a new feature essentially like on like Wednesday,
yeah,
Black Friday weekend, yeah, right? Which code freeze no more, because no, we are supposed to be in this world of Shopify safety where these things don't happen. And here it
That's
is
right.
that they actually happen. So I think it was a little bit of a kind of a paradoxical moment in time.
Yeah, especially. And, you know, what maybe I just got into some other LinkedIn wormhole, but I didn't see the like the kind of in the moment recaps that typically follow. Right. You talked about that, Rick, like Black Friday was kind of blah. Yes, there was a recap and there was some results, but Cyber Monday was very quiet. And I don't know what kind of happened there, but typically you do have people talking about, especially the retail pundits, like what they're seeing so far, and people are tracking the Shopify tracker and all the other data. And it just felt more quiet. And I don't know if because no one wanted to be wrong, right? No one wanted to kind of put it out there. So I that was my observation. I don't know if you guys felt the same.
Yeah. I mean, you know what, speaking of that kind of trend with this sort of pundit think situation, you know what's quietly died? That the whole idea of a doorbuster.
Yes,
yeah, I didn't see
the
one.
Lines of people waiting outside at 6 a.m. On Black Friday or not Cyber Monday. But I didn't see any of that.
No, there were no fights. No one got choked out. No one got hauled off to prison. It was pretty tame, right?
I mean, the mall was crowded, but it was very specific stores. So,
Yeah,
I think you're right, though. And by the way, they haven't reported because in many cases, Cyber Monday hasn't ended yet. So we're still waiting for the end. It's
like because it extended and then it extended again. And then so you're right. You're right, Nick. It's like it just keeps rolling, that train.
Yes, I love it.
All right. Well, Rick, can I walk us through who's sponsoring this fine program for our one viewer?
Yes, thank you, viewer. And we'll tell you a little bit about our sponsor, Miracle. Miracle is a platform which handles marketplaces, retail media, supplier onboarding, marketplaces. But the reality is you actually don't need another tool. You need a growth partner. The Miracle platform is powering the next era of retailers and brands who are ready to move, powered by AI and built for what's next. So thank you, Miracle, again, for partnering the show. All of us here and our listener appreciate you.
100%. Thank you so much. All right. So I think we're ready to hop into the headline hangover and see if Rick can keep this winning streak going. Okay. So I've got the first story, guys, because we're saving the best for last. Yeah, all right. Yes, Nick, Amazon what?
I mean, I can't believe I'm going to say this. I believe I read this in 30 minutes.
Yes, we will accept that answer. Half hour or less. That's correct.
I mean, it's nuts. And the standard was already impossible for people to match. I mean, I tried to buy something last. You guys know I'm a snacker. Less so today.
You but do love your snacks.
My snacks were running low, and then my iced coffee. And I wanted to buy a couple of snacks, and it said that if I paid $2.99, it could deliver to me between 4 a.m. and 8 a.m. this morning.
Whoa.
Which is a problem because the office isn't open to receive our packages.
Right,
but
right. Otherwise, you would have hit that, thank you, sir, may I have another?
Right. And like, who can match that already? Now, if I'm like, wait a minute, I'm going to step out, guys, because I realize I need snacks now. And by the time we're done, the amazing Trevor is done with Rick, my snacks will be here.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you're exactly right. They are testing this half hour or less delivery in 3 cities. It's in like part of this micro fulfillment centers versus, you know, they're not relying on their powerhouse like warehouses to funnel this in. It is your snacks. It's your groceries. So don't count out Amazon Fresh. It's just a fresh face and a new way to really kind of capture this market. You know, and yes, it's your coffee. It's your toilet paper. It's the stuff that you're like, oh, do I really want to run out to Walgreens? Am I going to use Instacart or DoorDash? Like those are, in my mind, the people that are ultimately kind of at risk here. It's like stealing some of those like high margin trips where you might walk into the store, pick up that thing you need and a couple other things. Probably like the Instacart DoorDash folks, right? Like they're just kind of in the game. I don't know. What's y'all's take?
Yeah, I think, you remember that whole 15-minute delivery revolution during
just
COVID?
Thinking about that.
Yes.
Going back to
ago.
GoPuff and
yes, GoPuff.
Cosmo.com. Cosmo.com.
Yeah, yeah, all those yeah. things. 15-minute grocery. All these things that wasted millions of dollars with no profit behind them. I mean, look, the good news for Amazon is that by the end of the year, they're going to cover like 2,600 cities with these same day fulfillment centers. Yeah. Walmart, you know, I believe the number is something like 20% of their deliveries are now like expedited 3 hours or less. And so Walmart is, you know, definitely, and those are things that people pay for. Like you have sure. to pay to expedite it, which is extra margin for them. And so Amazon is sort of like realizing that they need to up their game. This week, I also saw a notice from Target that they're still working on streamlining their fulfillment network to do sort of a next day, next morning delivery.
Right.
For Target, the problem is that you still get the Target items.
Well, it's Target.
Yeah.
Walmart has.
Yeah, they won't have it on the shelf. So
Walmart has thousands of distribution centers, right? And I think yeah. Walmart is opening non-consumer facing stores to be able to do this. And I saw something earlier this week about Walmart and its ability to sort of enhance the experience through delivery. But this is kind of nuts.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So we got 1 point there for Mr. Kaplan.
Yeah.
Starting out strong. Here we go.
That's great. Our next story is Omnicom IPG deal closes as a blank chase scale to revive growth.
Agencies.
Oh, Jess, with the win, agencies. Look, this is something that we've seen, and the big get bigger, and we seem to either be in this sort of consolidation phase or this right. sort of divestiture phase, and we're definitely in this big get bigger phase. You've seen Publicis, Sapient,
yes.
Nitro keep acquiring things, and Omnicom. IPG is just another multi-billion dollar revenue situation here where we have essentially $25 billion in revenue under management. They expect to realize about $750 million in cost synergies. By the way, no one ever actually realizes more than about a tenth of cost right. synergies that are ever.
But this is the investment thesis and it looks good on paper.
Always looks good on paper.
Looks great on paper. I can make a spreadsheet say a lot of things.
Look, the theory is, especially if you have some kind of technology and data backbone, the more data you have, the better decisions you can make in theory, the faster you can serve clients, and the more scale you get. That's the theory. The reality sometimes can be far different, but I think these medium-sized agencies, the idea is that these larger agencies can compete and be as nimble as small agencies, and that's a real disruptor to the market. So it'll remain to be seen if the medium-sized agencies can survive in this world.
I completely agree. I think there is sort of a tipping point where you just get so big and have so much power in the market that it becomes impossible to compete with that. And so as it gets harder, and by the way, as AI takes on more mm-hmm. Market mm-hmm. and ad creation and further sort of impacts on the margins of mid-market agencies, I think that these bigger agencies are buying revenue. They're buying some sort of to be realized cost savings. And I think it will just become harder and harder. It's like, are you going to open a bookstore in Bentonville? No.
Right.
I mean, it's like, this is a tough one for the world.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so are we going to split this thing or will there be a winner take all? Let's hit the next headline.
I actually am like, I can't win.
So. That's true, actually. So,
right? Yeah.
All right. Here you guys go. Amazon's blank drove sales on Black Friday.
Rufus?
Yeah, that would have been mine. Whoa, yeah, look at the little dog there. I love it.
Oh, he's so cute.
Well, what I mean, I bought a lot on Amazon on Black Friday and I actually did not use Rufus.
I didn't use Rufus either. I'm going to give you my take on Rufus. Like,
please.
Yes, Rufus can be helpful. But I think that there's like, I find it is the higher intent folks that already maybe Rufus is getting embedded everywhere. It's on the product page. It's like started now getting embedded more and more in like certain search experiences. It's almost like getting a little bit hard to avoid. And then I feel like it's not, is it driving incremental sales? Is it actually driving incremental conversion? Or is it just like helping the person find the stuff faster that would have found it anyway? I don't know that like the incrementality part has like really been unlocked. That's my maybe wrong take, but it just, I get there's a lot of hype about Rufus and it is cool. I've played around with it a little bit, but I don't feel like it's necessarily making me buy more.
That resonates with me. And I think, look, at some point, these tools are going to be so embedded that you're not going to be able to manage life without them. And so it's like, you have search. If search gets better, then whatever you did to make it better, better produce results, or you try again. And so I kind of think of it this all like that. At the same time, if you go to Google, there's the AI results. You can't avoid them. If you need more, if you need to interact more, you just hit the AI mode and you keep going. Did AI influence me or not? It's hard to say because it's there.
It's just always there.
You know who's really sort of, I think, quietly benefiting the Amazon Rufus thing? It's like everybody outside of Amazon. And I think that going back to the first story of the 30 minutes and the standards that Amazon's setting, I mean, I tell everybody that we work with, if you do not have an Amazon business, do not go into TikTok Shop, because guess what? TikTok Shop is the feeder of Amazon. So my sense is that people are discovering at TikTok Shop and other places, going to Amazon, and then to further validate or like evolve their search, they're using Rufus.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I want to know, show me, without me having to sort of filter, show me all 5-star reviews that are under certain price that are X. And like, that's Rufus. And so I agree with Rick. It's search.
Yeah. And I do think that the product page placement has been interesting because they are prompting with a couple of questions that I'm like, I'd rather do that than read. So I think that that's probably a pretty strong use case too.
Yeah, definitely in the cases where you're trying to figure out if this fits what I need or does it have the right materials? I don't want to have to hunt and peck for where it is or read guess from the reviews.
We talk all the time about like you can either trade in trust or you can trade on
price,
right? So in Amazon, we talk about like brand and status. And so years and years ago, right, I bought a Sony television because Sony invested in brand and I got trust. But that has been replaced today by the, you know, direct from manufacturer in China with 50,000, you know, 4.5 to 5-star reviews. So I want now Rufus to further sort of synthesize that result for me and validate. And so that, again, I think is where we're seeing like Rufus is getting me from where I go, where I want to be, or like where I am to where I want to be.
Yep.
That sounds like a theme song. Rufus takes you where you want to go.
I think we could probably write an AI song about it and make it a number one.
On Suno.
And then we'll have to get we'll have to get some kind of like directors and officers insurance before, because we'll be sued by whomever it goes out and copyright infringes.
Yeah. Well, I think this is a great place to wrap Headline Hangover. I'm just over here tallying my 100th win. So I don't know actually how many it is, but it's pretty high up there. And you know, we talk about analytics, we talked about data, trust, truth. It's a great way to introduce our next guest, Trevor Testwide, CEO of Measured. Nick, you introduced this relationship, so would love to have you share a few words about Trevor before we roll into the interview that he and Rick had.
Yeah, so I met Trevor, let's see, 4 or 5 years ago through a consultant who was part of the Chameleon Collective, Daniel Paul, who still I do stuff with today, who's an incredible performance marketer. And he said, we're making sort of like not the best decisions because we're not using incrementality testing. Mm. And I was like, what's incrementality testing? Because I didn't really know. And now it's like super common. And I think everyone is just like throwing it in. And so I met Trevor with Daniel and it was like, okay, one call. It was like, we're done. Like sign us up for all of our brands. I was at Sadia. Yep. And we began using it to measure the true incrementality of all of our paid media. Mm. And so that's where my relationship with him began. But he started measured after a career in sales and analytics in 2017 and has grown it into more than just incrementality testing. There's now all kinds of mixed media modeling and other things they do to help businesses not just understand like the measurement of their paid media investments and things they do, but like how to better structure media. And so it is an incredible company. There are definitely competitors. The market's gotten sort of crowded, right? But it is a really amazing tool. He's a super interesting, charismatic guy. And I think that I am excited to hear the conversation between he and Rick because Rick asks great questions. Trevor has an inside track on measurement, which is so important to all of us. So that is my intro on Trevor, on Measured, and I think it's going to be a great conversation.
Yeah, just to preview it briefly, we go all over the map from kind of the history of search marketing back in the day, like last click, multi-touch, you know, into incrementality. So we cover kind of the gamut of what's happening. How do people know if their marketing is effective, which is really the only question anyone ever thinks about.
Yeah, I hope
sure
that
is.
People
how we sleep at night, guys.
We'll take away from this conversation, iROAS. So,
love it.
Oh, it is your Thank friend. You. All right.
All right. We are here with Trevor Testweed, the CEO of Measured. He spent his career in the marketing attribution and measurement space from early days. And you might say he's a little bit of a glutton for punishment in this space. So welcome to the show, Trevor.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me, Rick. Yeah, the last 15 years wrestling with this cross-channel attribution problem.
Does it make you excited to hear that number 15 years, or does it make you like a little sad at times?
You know what? I'm still very inspired by the category because it's actually the problem statement that I've been chasing down for so long is finally now solvable, right? We were chasing down this kind of holy grail measurement methodology of multi-touch attribution for such a very long time. And now with incrementality measurement and how that's come into the marketplace and it's exposing the truth and it works and we're seeing the proof points. And so I'm probably even 15 years, like worn in the category, I'm probably more inspired by it than I ever
That's
been,
great.
To be honest.
That's always great to like fall in love with the problem. So kudos to you and Measured, which has had a lot of success. Look, I think the average person intuitively understands the importance of measurement, meaning like you go back to, I'm not an advertising expert in any stretch of the imagination. You go back to the John Wanamaker quote, 50% of my ads are working. I just don't know which 50. And so at the end of the day, that leads buyers, marketers, brand builders on a journey to figure out how to understand the effectiveness of their strategies and tactics in a scientific way. So with what seems like a noble goal, what gets broken along the way with regards to marketing measurement?
Yeah, I think there have been several methodologies a lot of us have chased down, and most notably back in 2000, for me, 2011, 12, 13, we were chasing the holy grail of multi-touch attribution, mapping a user's events, impressions, and clicks across all of the platforms, online and offline, to an omni-channel transaction. And, you know, on a whiteboard or in a conference room, it was dreamy, but on the field in practice, it didn't play out that way. And it just got more challenging over time. And in 2016, a lot of us here on the Measure team and living in the category, we all kind of arrived at the same place that user level path building methodologies were quickly becoming obsolete and no longer viable. And, you know, we had this vision for incrementality measurement being a must-have capability. We started experimenting with it, seeing it work. And so the thesis when we started Measured was that the privacy era was here, user level measurement was going away, cohort based measurement and specifically experimentation to inform incrementality was going to be a must have for consumer brands. And at the end of the day, incrementality is what we've all been chasing down, regardless, yeah. regardless of the methodology. And when I say that, I'll just define it because I think a lot of people get a little bit confused, right? As to what it is. It's pretty simple. It's understanding if your ads are actually driving outcomes, right? Mm. Or if the ad exposure is simply correlated to the outcome, right? Would the outcome have happened anyway, right? And there's some percentage of folks that are exposed to the ad and are on a path to converting and they have high intent and there's high intent audiences that are going to convert with or without the ad. We want to tease that out and understand what percentage of those conversions are incrementally driven causality by the the ad exposure. Yeah.
Yeah. So this is, I mean, super important because you're implying things like but for tests, like, is this necessary? Is this sufficient? You know, for the transaction, if it's removed, if the transaction continue? And so as a result, you're getting a much more nuanced view of what's driving the success of your campaigns.
That's the goal. That's the goal. Yeah.
So let's back up a little bit to the beginning and talk about the attribution models, even before MTA. Let's, you know, there are a number of them and some I still see today. Last touch. Mm-hmm. What does last touch mean?
Yeah, last touch means any media platform that is in the converting path, like they're seeing that user that they're able to conversion track to the outcome, they're going to take 100% credit for that outcome. So if, you know, branded search, which is sitting at the bottom of the funnel and harvesting demand, is seeing that outcome along with Meta and affiliate and you name it, if the platform is seeing it and are able to track to the conversion, they're going to take 100% credit for that outcome, that transaction.
Got it.
And so I got into the category in 2011. At that time, there was a lot of frustration with these last touch metrics. And now here, 15 years later, you still see big media budgets that are anchored on this last touch attribution methodology. It's and the primary reason, it's very easy. There's a lot of inertia. It's easy to institutionally adopt. And there's change pain to hitting reset on.
Right. And the people that are making the decisions aren't always the people that are running the campaigns.
That too. And there's a lot of people who are consuming marketing performance reporting. And so it's not just marketing. It's up and down marketing. But then it's into finance and controllers and the CFO and the C-suite and board reporting. Right. So it's a lot of people who are consuming marketing performance reporting. They're also looking at period over period reporting and trending. Yeah. And so while most all now recognize that the methodology that has been universally or institutionally adopted is broken, it's a hell of an effort to go through resetting it and quite disruptive to the brand. And it's not just last touch, right? There's also been quite a bit of inertia around these flawed click-based MTA models. Multi-touch attribution, you know, methodology I chased down for a long time has largely ended up as a click path building exercise. Yeah.
Yeah. And so let's move beyond last touch a little bit and get into some of your multi-touch attribution history, because I think in theory, it sounds like a great idea. Like, let's take privacy. Let's assume there's no privacy concerns out of the equation for a second, just sort of like, let's assume we have the signal. It's not about missing signal.
Yeah.
The idea that I click on a branded paid ad and then I go to Google Shopping and then I show up in the store and then I ultimately get served a contextual ad when I go to Facebook and then I click through and buy. The idea that each of those things in some way contributed to the journey is an appealing one, isn't it?
And I'm not saying it's not contributing to the journey, right? But the fantasy that you can connect all of these events along a path to an ID, whether it's an impression further up in the funnel, or it's a click, or it's retargeting down at the bottom of the funnel to, let's say, a retail transaction. In theory, it is the holy grail. We could do that. We'd all be doing it. right? And up until about 2016, we could kind of sort of land it with reasonable data reconciliation issues. Mm-hmm. And then in 2016, I was running a company called Conversion Logic, largely anchored on multi-touch attribution. And the walls were starting to go up. There was a point in time where I could map YouTube to Meta to a search click to a conversion. And it was in 2016 that the walls were going up and I could no longer map those events. I could map clicks, but I was missing those views, which is a lot of the media influence. Right. And so then, you know, on the field with a lot of big brands, we started building out experiments to inform all of these blind spots that were popping up because we could not map those views and impressions, right? Upper funnel into mid funnel into lower funnel. So if we could do it, we'd all be doing it. It is dreamy, especially when you look at, like, you know, closing the loop and sending measurement right back into programmatic. But that is just not the reality with an ad ops team, or it's not where the industry has gone, especially with the privacy era.
Yeah, for sure. And definitely, when you talk to, any reasonable size brand these days, privacy is one of their top concerns because there's so many different states with privacy laws before you even have to even start to deal with Europe and beyond. How does that complicate the measurement process?
So for us, I mean, we've built for it, right? Mm-hmm. So prior to Measured, I had, been part of two teams building MTA MMM businesses. We saw the writing on the wall based on the experience I just shared that the privacy era was coming. And so our methodology has been anchored in cohorts and is privacy safe. And, we started really focusing on experimentation, all varieties of experimentation, which is built for the privacy era. So we're solving that cross-channel attribution problem that we went after against a deterministic identity path, and now doing it with cohorts. Because at the end of the day, what we're all trying to get to is, what is the incremental marginal contribution of the media? And if you can't do it at the user level, let's understand it at the audience or the ad set level.
Got it. And you used a word in there that I want to make sure everyone understands: MMM or media mix modeling. What is that in relation to some of the TLAs we've already brought up, like last touch attribution or multi-touch attribution?
Yeah, media mix modeling is a methodology that has been around for a very long time. I think north of 50 years, and it essentially, at its core, it tells you how correlated your media spend is with your sales over time. So it's a correlation-based methodology, and it is not causal. And that is the weak link in it. We've been really focused on incrementality from the beginning, which is our position is the strongest mechanism to getting you to causality. And there is a lot of value in a mixed model, media mix model. We then continuously feed that causal signal into a media mix model to validate and calibrate the mixed model, essentially to make it a trusted optimization tool, right? So we can look across the entire media mix against omni-channel transactions. The reality is not all these channels and tactics elegantly line up to an experiment. There's a number of channels that we don't have a clean test and control experiment for, and there's a lot of value in the mixed model. But a mixed model on its own, independent of causality, it is far from a magic bullet. It can be a nice compass, right, and a valuable decision making tool. But the more causality you feed that mixed model, the more reliable and suggested.
Yeah. So, if a CFO says, this mix model is really how we should allocate our marketing spend, your response to him is like, how do you know which ones are really driving that sale versus which ones are just sort of hanging around, as sort of bystanders to the transaction?
Yeah. So we line up to the CFOs quite a bit. More and more today, That is the exact right. sponsor on our engagement is the CFO. And part of the reason is incrementality, causality is the language of finance, right? Right. And so my response right. would be, there's a lot of value in that mix model, but it on its own is not going to be the magic bullet for you, right? You've got to anchor it in as much incrementality and streamline an incrementality practice feeding into the mix model. And today that would be an agile mix model that gets you to causality, gets you to speed. Our mix model is updated daily and it gets you to granularity, which is getting your reads down to the campaign and sub-campaign, essentially the ad set level.
Yeah, I wanted to broach a topic because it feels like during, I don't know, sometime in the last 10 years, a lot of people got trained on the term ROAS. And, and in particular, trained that if something was high ROAS, then it's worth doing. If it's not high ROAS, it's not worth doing. Mm-hmm. Independent of any other metrics and using it as a backward-looking steering wheel.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, because obviously you're looking backwards to determine ROAS, but you're using that to then determine where your next dollar is going to go.
Yeah.
How did we get to this point where CFOs are, some of them are still there?
Yeah. So first I would say it's simple, right? And it's right. visible. It's easy to calculate. It's a bit of a shared language, become a shared language between CMOs and CFOs. But just because it's simple doesn't mean it's exactly accurate, right? Uh-huh. So what we do is we partner with brands to recalibrate that ROAS into an incremental ROAS. ROAS is capturing all conversion activity against that spend, right? So it's looking back and there's a bit of an illusion on accountability there, especially when you're being guided to low funnel media and you're overinvested in low incrementality media sitting at the bottom of the funnel and you're capturing a lot of high intent audiences that are low in incrementality, that can be a pretty dangerous metric. So our first goal is to recalibrate that ROAS metric, put it in incremental terms. But ideally, especially to the point of the CFO, you're looking at something more like incremental contribution margin to per dollar is really what you want to get to, representing the percentage of sales that are incremental after you take out variable costs. Right. But it's kind of like ROAS is here and you see it everywhere, just like you see last touch metrics everywhere
100%.
Because they're easy. They're organizationally adopted. There's a ton of inertia around it. And our goal, I think the industry has gotten there. It's let's now understand it on an incremental basis because you can get a very different decision. When you take a ROAS metric, especially for, you know, low funnel media and you recalibrate it into an incremental metric. That decision can change radically.
Yeah. And how do you, like, for a CFO that's just not in the game, they don't understand what the models necessarily mean. They know, they see the dollars going out. They see the model being showed that this is what the model told us. Let's say they were sold on a mixed model, like some kind of mixed model, and they aren't sure what's happening next. Like, how do you viscerally explain to them why what they're doing is wrong without using the number side of it?
Well, a lot of times when we'll step in, there's a natural tension between marketing and finance, right? Mm. And so when we show up speaking the language of margin return and causality and incrementality, like they are so excited to see us and the red carpet gets rolled out. I was like, where the hell have you been all my life? I've been trying to explain this to marketing, right? And so they welcome us with open arms. So when we have them in an engagement and we have finance and marketing lined up to each other, it can be pretty powerful. It's when you see the businesses move, right? Yeah.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, it's interesting. So for you to tell it, there's a built-in incentive for marketing to be not as efficient as it could be because it allows them to spend more? Or do you just think that that's just the comfort zone of the marketer not being so causal oriented?
There can be a comfort zone. There can be a bias, right, against a media channel or two. There's a variety of reasons organizationally. They could be incredibly busy and they just don't want to deal with how disruptive, you know, deploying a much smarter measurement methodology is. But we, myself and many of us in the industry have been out evangelizing smarter measurement for a very long time. It kind of shocks me. We're here in 2025 and you still see like $50 million plus budgets that are anchored on Google Analytics or Adobe or platform metrics. And nobody is disagreeing that it's wrong, right? I don't think it's a question that's argued anymore, but it's quite disruptive to go through the institutional adoption of this smarter metric just or for a variety of reasons that we talked about.
Got it. And so to the skeptics you speak with, what is their kind of road to Damascus aha moment look and sound like? You know, they come into the meeting thinking this way. They have a number of discussions with you. What are the barriers that start to fall?
When you bring them along the journey and you start to expose reads that they were very suspicious about because they have a hypothesis, right? Is they're looking at the business and they can feel, you know, in a board meeting, you have marketing showing up and talking about how great they're doing. The business is not feeling it. Right. So when you start to expose insights that line up with their instinct, right, their gut and how and the larger perspective on how the business is performing, you build trust and it's really bringing them into the fold. And then trust is certainly built over time. But like I said, it's like it is the language of executives. It's shocking to me how many C-suites show up, how many board members log into our platform, and they're relieved that we're finally going through this exercise. I don't think there's a lot of people that are going hard in the paint for last touch metrics anymore.
You know, it's something that everyone is moving away from at some point. In terms of measurement, obviously, it's something that you need to be doing. It's information. It's a guidepost, but it's not something to optimize for its own sake. Could you talk about the different types of abuses of measurement that you see? You know, I don't even know if that's a fair question, given the name of your company is Measured, but wanted to kind of broach this topic and kind of start talking about it.
Yeah. So where there's like a buffet of measurement methodologies that are on the table, right? And folks have certain agendas organizationally, depending on where you sit. You know, if you sit in branded search or you sit in affiliate, you sit in retargeting, as opposed to if you sit all the way up the funnel, most folks recognize which of these methodologies is going to best support their agenda. And so there's some selection bias in who is picking which methodologies. You know, with experimentation, I don't see as much resistance on experimentation as I saw in the MTA world, where I show up with a big brand. You've got the search person who's showing up arms folded, knowing that we're coming after their budget. I haven't experienced that same resistance here. I think most now kind of line up to, you know, a test and learn motion of experimentation is now a must-have capability.
Right.
It's a must-have discipline in the organization, right? It's not like this thing you can do once a year. And I don't know, maybe it's selection bias because these are the people that we're talking to, I don't see the resistance that I used to organizationally. But yeah, I think you know, it's a pretty exciting time for us and the industry, because the industry is now lined up with support from the big platforms as well. Like you see, you know, Meta and Google and the platforms have got religion around this too. Right? You see them talking about incrementality measurement, triangulation, and test and learn agendas, and you know, we'll show up, you know, with Meta or with Google or the platform and partnering with the brand to set up test and learn agendas. Which is the right thing for the brand and marketer and all key stakeholders. Yeah. So I don't know if I answered your question. No, it's kind of the reality where we're at right now, which is it's exciting. Yeah.
Obviously, look, most brands need test and learn. A lot of brands don't know or have had trouble allocating resource to it understand what kind of teams that you need to implement test and learn.
Yeah.
Like from an organizational point. So there's sort of like a, you're bringing a gospel that has a couple of different parts. There's tech and measurement,
yes.
but there's also sort of like people and process.
That's right.
Let's start with the people and the process side. A test and learn campaign, who needs to be around the table?
Yeah, great question. Well, I think you just have to get started, right? So you have to have some people around the table that buy in.
Anyone around the table to buy into
the value and incrementality measurement, and why test and learn is a value to, you know, the principles that they're lined up against. And then where I get clients that are just getting started is Meta's got a great conversion lift test product, and the platforms are now starting to offer capabilities to get you started. And so that's usually the path of least resistance, is to get a test going with Meta and start to organizationally understand that difference between you've got a last touch metric and now you've got a read on incrementality. Let's look at that and let's start to line up to how is this moving my decisions, and organizationally, you know, talk about it and socialize it. And is this compelling and interesting to our North Star goals? And then you start to look at it a little bit broader, and you start to look at it across platforms. Okay, we've got this read on Meta and how has it influenced our decisions there. Now let's look to our next couple of channels, whether it's with Google or Pinterest or you name it. But it's just, you got to just get started, put one foot in front of the other, right? And organizationally just start to try to understand, you know, what it can mean to the business. It is, when adopted, it's very powerful. But it's not about trying to like boil the ocean, get it all done in, you know, in a 6 month period.
So talk to me about the things that I should be testing. Give me a set of things. Then for instance, obviously if I'm talking about like CRO on a website, I mean, clearly that's just part that starts at a landing, you know, the traditional CFO or CRO like starts at a landing page, ends at a purchase, right? And you're trying to make sure that the conversion rate comes right. In media measure, you know, advertising measurement, there are a number of other things. There's obviously a lot of components to that, which channels you're on, how you show up there, you know, your price, your creative, where also depends on where you're going. What are the things that you should be constantly testing?
Yeah, well, follow your spend, right? So start on your biggest channels and tactics. And so typically we'll start with Google and Meta. And often customers will show up with a hypothesis. They'll have an instinct around a spend. You know, and one place that is not uncommon for us to start is branded search, right? And so there's strategic reasons you use branded search, but from a performance perspective, branded search is often used navigationally. And so if you look at the platform metric, branded search sitting at the bottom of the funnel, harvesting that can look really dreamy. It looks like it has an amazing outsized return, right? And then you apply this lens of incrementality, and you now understand that, hey, it's really only 15% or 20% incremental compared to what it's taking credit for. So I would start with your biggest spend channels and tactics, and then follow your instinct on where you think the waste may exist, or on the other side, the opportunity may exist. Because on the other side of the spectrum, upper funnel is also very hard for the platforms to measure, because their conversion tracking really struggles to measure things like YouTube or Facebook awareness or connected TV. An important thing to note here is when you're doing incrementality measurement, you're measuring the relationship between paid media and the source of truth transaction from the brand, whether that is e-com, retail, Amazon, Sephora, Ulta. As long as we have access to it, we're going to measure that relationship. And you know, where I say, you know, we may apply an 85% haircut to branded search, you know, upper funnel, something like YouTube, we may say, hey, they deserve three times the credit that they're getting, that their own platform's taking credit for, because it's not seeing a lot of the conversion behavior.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, you mentioned some of the goals and where people should start. It sounds like eliminating waste is definitely part of that, which implies sort of two things. Number one, just eliminating waste for the, you know, because no one likes to waste money. Yep. But also to reallocate that spend into more effective channels.
Yeah.
That leaves out the, you know, whenever someone does something big, launches a new product, comes up with a big new creative concept, how does measurement help you there? How could you use measurement to inform future looking decisions in that kind of realm?
So is measurement and optimization go together, right? Mm. And usually the first place we'll start is let's identify the waste. And right. we're 9 years in, we work with 160 brands. We deploy hundreds of experiments every quarter. We have a pretty good instinct on where we expect, you know, the best places to start when we step into a new brand. Yeah. So first place we want to start is let's identify the waste. And then let's identify the opportunities to reallocate that spend.
Yeah.
And drive growth or just drive more efficiency with that spend. Right. So it's building a recomposition of the spend across the portfolio. And then doing it against my growth and efficiency goals. So the scenario planning, running what if analysis, I've got another $200,000 to spend over the next 2 weeks, or I've got another $2 million to spend over the next month. How is it most effectively deployed? Accounting for diminishing returns, right? And testing in, when you're running tests, there's really two treatments. You've got a holdout treatment and then you have a scale up treatment. So I know TikTok works for me at $200,000 to spend. I want to test into that diminishing return curve and see, hey, can I make it work at 350? Can I make it work at 500? Can I make it work at a million? And let's test into that question statement and then feed those scale test results into the media mix model that you do scenario planning with and forecasting.
Right. No, it makes a lot of sense because I think a lot of people don't immediately understand the fact that you don't have data. You do it. You have to try it out.
Yeah.
And so always, you know, it might be the other side of the CFO. They may not be super happy about that. But I think the fact that there might be some guardrails gets everyone a little more comfortable that at every step in the journey, we can dial it back. We can put our foot in the accelerator a little bit more.
And let's see how the business responds. It's all about trying to understand that relationship between the media and the business outcome. You know, the other thing I'll point out on MMM, as you just mentioned, we don't have a lot of data. Maybe it's a new channel. We haven't tried Apple. Right. We haven't tried connected TV. A media mix model is looking back typically on 3 years of data. And they're modeling, they're building this correlation model between, you know, spend and outcomes, right? And if it doesn't have anything to model on, it's going to really struggle, or it's just going to require some guesswork, some estimation from the modeler.
Yeah.
And that's where incrementality can be very helpful, right? Serving as buyers into a model where I have data scarcity.
This is a fascinating topic because I think, a lot of the brands that you work with, they're under new ownership. They have new product lines. Mm-hmm. A new designer comes in. They're trying to appeal to a new audience. Mm-hmm. So the business isn't static based on comps anymore.
Yeah.
And so as a result, your year-on-years just should look a little bit better. Everything is out the window because you used to have a product that looked like this, and now your product is completely different.
Mm-hmm,
what do you do in those situations? And what do you advise people in those situations?
It's a really good point. I mean, I would guide you to testing again, right? So you're testing out a new audience, or you've got a new product, or you've got, you know, new strategy, new positioning. Testing, we're looking at, let's say, a 4 to 6 week, maybe 8 week period of time. Mm-hmm. And let's test into new strategies and products against, and oftentimes we'll do it at the product level, right? It just doesn't have to just be at the channel or the tactic. If you've got enough data, we can do it against a product or something more specific like that.
The eras that you talked about, you know, we're in a situation where, you know, these platforms are being built. They're all based on last touch.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we try to step into this multi-touch world, which seems great in theory, but it's harder than we think it is to model. Now we don't even have the signals. We have to do things that are cohort-based in this sort of privacy-first world. Where is the puck moving from here? And it seems like we're in this, we're not leaving this privacy era anytime soon. Mm-hmm. Incrementality is sort of the holy grail. Like, if I spend an additional dollar, where should I spend that dollar? What can I use to drive the most effective incremental sale, whether it's based on whatever business metric I'm, whether it's revenue or whether it's contribution margin? Are you just going to be here for the next 15 years, or is there another era that you'll have to adjust to that you see shaping up with the LLMs, how conversational commerce is evolving, if you want to call it that?
Yeah. So AI is very relevant to the future of this category and where we're going. Yeah. If you look at companies like Measured, Measured is anchored in machine learning from day one, right? Which is modeling off structured data. We have a lot of unstructured intelligence that we collect, that our clients collect, that are very relevant to these decisions that we're lining up against. And so we have re-architected our platform across the entire stack to take advantage of the intelligence the LLMs have and unstructured data intelligence that we have access to. So incrementality is, that is the North Star that we're trying to answer, right? Is the causal contribution of media to the business. Experimentation, you know, as far as we can see right now, it's extremely, is going to be extremely important. Feeding into an agile mix model is very relevant. And then there is benefit to bringing in the LLMs, both conversationally and in the product, just to make the intelligence more accessible, right? Sometimes these products can be pretty intimidating when folks step into them. And people don't have a lot of patience, right? They have the, they step into a tool, they have a similar expectation to how they interact with like a B2C tool when they come into a B2B tool. And if they can't very quickly and easily get access to the insight or the decision or the optimization conclusion, they're popping out of your tool very quickly.
Right.
And so the conversational is really level one AI that we are building in is really important to our workflows. And then level two AI is the logic that is applied, that is typically applied by humans that we're bringing into the tool as well. And so the LLMs and AI is very important to where the category is going, where Measured is gone.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. On the consumer side, how do you view these new companies and new, you know, platforms like ChatGPT? Do you view them as a channel and that's how you view them? Or do you view them as an accelerator of the existing channels? You know, for instance, someone having a conversation with their phone while they're standing in a retail store. Do you see that the same as you saw Google, just different? Or do you see it as more like an Amazon marketplace? Or do you see it as both?
Yeah. To play out, right? But it's clear that consumers are doing discovery in these tools, right? And they're doing research and discovery is in very similar behavior to how they've used Google. Right. So it's the early innings. Clearly, we're seeing the adoption and it's not going anywhere. It's only going to accelerate.
Yeah.
So I certainly see this as a discovery mechanism for consumers. And we'll see how it's early innings for advertising within these tools. Right. You saw like Perplexity kind of started going down the path and then, you know, remove the person or he stepped away who was leading it. And so there's no one really kind of at the helm there. And
ads are coming. They're coming.
Yeah, no question. But like how they approach it is still TBD. And when ads are there, it's going to be, you know, our job to show up and determine how we're going to measure its incremental effectiveness.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
No, that's exciting. I mean, you're in it now. Right?
Yes.
You're in this maelstrom of like changes that are happening. And so it has to be a really exciting time to be a CEO at a measurement company.
Very, very exciting. Yeah. And it's not just the early adopters. Like when we started the business for such a long time, it was really just folks that were more on the bleeding edge of adopting innovation. And now you've experienced like the crossing the chasm where that early majority is showing up and more mature, slower moving brands recognize that they need this innovation. They need causality, they need speed and agility, and they need the granularity that traditional tools are not providing. So it's a really exciting time to be in this category.
Awesome. I mean, this has been a fantastic conversation, Trevor. I really appreciate all your insights that you've delivered today. If folks want to learn more about Measured, where is best for them to find out?
Yeah, measured.com, or you can find me on LinkedIn.
Awesome. Trevor Testweed, it's been really fabulous to have you on today. Look forward to chatting again soon.
Thanks so much for having me, Rick. I appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this week's Watson Weekend. If you've made it this far, you're either a retail masochist or you just love the sound of our voices.
I'm going to say it's option two. Either way, we appreciate you. If you've enjoyed today's show, give us a follow, give us a like wherever you're listening. Leave us a review, preferably with 5 stars. We'll take 4.5 if you're feeling okay. A little bit stingy. Yeah, it's okay.
And don't just lurk on the channel. Share this with a friend, colleague.
That's right. We're kind of like your little sidekick, helping you bring everybody along in your organization. You can find us on LinkedIn, your Spotify, all the places. And all the links are in the show notes, too.
Big thanks to the community, our listeners, as well as the Kaplan Snacks that keep this circus running. Sponsors, you know who you are. And if you're not a sponsor yet,
I mean, what are you actually doing with your marketing budget? Give us a ring. Call us. Send an email. Rick loves when people slide into his DM. It's his favorite place.
Until next time, I'm Rick Watson.
And I'm Jessica Lisewski. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. Now, you can feel like you can go on and do something better with your life. We'll see you next week.
Bye.